I don't even think that that's a serious question, because if you're a teacher, of course, it depends on the situation that you're put in. If you're teaching religion, it's one thing. If you're teaching mathematics, it's another thing. But if I'm a mechanic, if I'm a cook, if I'm this or that, to the extent I have an interior unity to my life based on Christ, it doesn't make any difference who's around me. I'd say the impact is going to be important whether you're surrounded by non-Catholics or Catholics, because God help us, the Catholics need edification as much as anyone else.
Does academic freedom have any value whatsoever?
No, I mean, it's a joke.
Not that it's a joke. I agree it's a joke.
Yeah.
But if it could actually be achieved, would it be a desirable thing?
There are two different things. When you say academic freedom, the normal scenario is you have this professor who has so much truth. He goes into a place and he teaches, and the people fire him because the people don't like what he's saying. Now, the doctrine of academic freedom in one sense means an institution will hire a professor and check out his qualifications, and then they'll say the professor is free to lecture and write in whatever direction his sense of truth takes him, even if he's objectively wrong. So that's the sense of academic freedom. Now, the distinction is this. If you have a yeshiva, if you have a Jewish school, and the entire reason the school exists is to form young people into understanding the world the way the Orthodox Jews understand the world, well, then it would be someone might come in there and get hired and start preaching racism, Nazi racism and all that, and he might say, academic freedom, but he is not free to contradict the purpose of the university or of the yeshiva. So there have to be two meanings to academic freedom. The body itself, the institution itself, has to be free to present its worldview to those who want to hear it. Say at Fordham, I'm talking about universities now, Fordham should be free, and it should tell the world, if you want to hear what the atheists say, the relativists, the skeptics, the Marxists, you get it half price. We got all these schools here. If you want to hear what a specifically Catholic worldview is when it comes to faith and reason and art and history and government, come to us. Therefore, we should hire people who agree with the purpose of the institution. We give them a little elbow room instead of zapping them for every little thing, but ultimately say there are limits beyond which you may not go. We do not want atheists teaching religion. If you're a professor of mathematics, you just shut up about atheism and stick to mathematics. That's perhaps acceptable, and so on. So academic freedom, in the first place, applies to the institution, which is free to present its unique worldview. And that used to be the raison d'etre of Jewish universities, Methodist, Catholic, and so on. They're all becoming like Yale and Harvard now. They're all becoming desacralized. And now, when they hire someone, it has nothing to do with a corporate commitment to any worldview. It has to do with publication. So if you have enough publication, Fordham will hire you, Fairfield will hire you, and Notre Dame, and so on. But you can then contradict the very institution that gives you a job. That's pure nonsense.
But there is no. The institutions of themselves have no standard.
They have no commitment. They will not. No. They don't even want to stand for truth. So that's one of the reasons why we had. And therefore, school is boring as anything. At least in the old days, people who contradict each other, some of them are wrong. There's no doubt about it. But at least you have this earnest debate about where truth lies. Only 100 years ago, Harvard was a wonderful hotbed of religious dispute, believe it or not. I can't believe it. But William James is our most favorite, our most famous American philosopher. He was a professor in 1905. That's 90 years ago. He got the whole student body aroused about Pascal's wager on whether God exists. He had a series of lectures on religious experience. He had a whole series of lectures on the will to believe. So Harvard itself was in a turmoil over the question of whether Christ is God. You can't even get the Vatican or any Jesuit to get in a turmoil over that. So we've lost an awful lot. And school is boring. I mean, in general, universities are boring.
Second question. Are there Jewish, Orthodox Jewish colleges?
Yeah, well...
How are they doing?
Well,
are
not that well
their
either.
Jewish, their First Testament really
there's this Jewish Theological Seminary. We co-sponsored with them a seminar on Buber. Martin Buber was a great Jewish philosopher. He's the one who wrote books on I and Thou. And I heard a couple of lectures by the professors that they seem somewhat Orthodox to me. They're not strictly Orthodox. I don't think there's a single Jewish institution in America. You might have a rabbinical training school, but I'm talking about a university. But the Jewish Theological Seminary, there was this man, Rabbi Berkowitz, a brilliant man, and he chewed up his fellow Jews. He said, what are we doing to the law of Moses? We have replaced the temple with the university. That's a quite good thing. So I know plenty of Orthodox rabbis from Brooklyn. Rabbi Levin is a good friend of mine. He's always in Operation Rescue and everything else. But in general, the Jews are shrinking to non-being. The real believing Jews, they have the burden of a very difficult law. They have something like 631 precepts. So they're cutting corners. They're using Jesuitical principles to get around some of them. But they are fraction in the state of Israel, too, by the way. They're only fraction.
It's in Spring Valley, New York. I mean, you see these little boys. I mean, I'm sure that kids can be so mean to everybody and they walk around with the long curls and everything. But they're very much into the Shiva and the Jewish religion and walking. I mean, I've seen them in a car. That's why you always see them. And they really are very, very religious, these little kids. And they're like high school age. I mean, they're not college. But I'm just wondering.
They'll learn better when they get to NYU, though. They'll lose it all. I have this brilliant student of mine. I taught 38 years, and I'm in my 38th year. My most brilliant student was my former wife who died. She was from France. She was a pure genius. But about number four down the list is this Jewish woman, Margarita, who calls herself a Jew. She married an Arab, and the minute she conceived, he died. So the baby was born without a father. And the baby now is 18. She was raised in a yeshiva. She went to all these schools. And she reads Hebrew and all that. She has the faith, but the mother doesn't. So now the baby, her name is Jojo. She's going to NYU one more year, and she'll be a secular Jew. Because she looks at her mother. She said to her mother, how about this, how about that? And the mother just, we don't really do this. And the mother's a genius. So that's probably the status. There's a tremendous identity crisis, a tremendous identity. Nobody is willing to believe there's any truth, least of all in his own clan. I mean, the Jews are probably ashamed of their curly hair and their father's beard. The way when I was a young kid, I was ashamed of being Italian. Until I went to Italy. No more.
Allow me to make a comment on that. If you define an Orthodox Jew as he who follows the Mosaic Law, none exist in this country. None. Because the Mosaic Law requires execution of people for certain rules, and some of them are your own family members. If you remember, St. Joseph was unwilling to expose the Blessed Mother to the law, as he says, because he was a just man. The point is, the same law that says, thou shalt not have graven images, thou shalt not eat pork, also says, if a son is disrespectful and strikes his father, kill him. Now, no Orthodox Jew does this. And as St. James says, he who violates one part of the law violates all. And that's a Christian principle. But the principle is this. If you're following the Mosaic Law, and you take Commandment 1 to be as important as Commandment 12, and you always follow Commandment 1 and completely ignore Commandment 12, then you are caught in a state of formalized hypocrisy. And I think that's one of the reasons, number one, why the Orthodox Jew should come into the church. He should realize that his law is no longer enforceable. But literally, nowhere in this country do you ever see on any of the tabloid TV shows an Orthodox Jew who killed his son. They don't do it. The reason they don't do it, same reason we don't do it, is against the law both of God and man. But their argument is it's in favor of the law of God, but it's against the law of man. They serve man, and they're caught in this horrible dilemma, which I personally think is one of the reasons the Mosaic Law was put there, was to show you at a certain point, hey, listen, you can't follow anymore. Got to be something else. Means the Messiah had to come. Let's look for him. I think it's a road to redemption for the Jew. But the point I'm simply trying to make is Judaism, and this was explained to me by a gentleman named David Morse, who heads the Hebrew Catholic Association, which he advocates a specific right in the church for the racial Jew. And he argues that what they have presented now, what you see today, what we call Judaism today, is the rabbinic system and not the Mosaic law at all. It is, by definition, a fraud. Because the Mosaic law was a sacrificial system, Mosaic laws, sacrifices in the temple, and a priestly system. What you now have is a group of teachers of wisdom, the rabbis. You have no more priests, you have no more sacrifices, you have no more temple, you have no more Mosaic law. What you have is a certain cultural vestige left over. And as he points out, these people aren't religious Jews at all. They're not even following the Mosaic law. They're following a new religion which was founded after the destruction of the temple. It started around the time of Jesus, some kind of descendant of Phariseeism, but essentially a heresy from the Mosaic law. I just pointed out because you might be interested in the point I'm making is I think David Morris has a good point. I think more Catholics that know about it today.
You know, they say in Brooklyn, there are a lot of the many Jewish communities in Brooklyn, they're trying to live according to as many of the laws as they can. It's a tremendous burden. Now, one of them is on Sabbath, from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown, you're not supposed to leave the precincts of your community. I forgot exactly what that means. So what they would do is arbitrarily take yellow tape and string it along telephone poles, say 5 mile circumference, and then by that little legalism, it's now allowed for them to go here, 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 here. So that's a tremendous burden. It's a tremendous burden. Otherwise, they'd be locked into their own apartment. So, and as Vinny said, they have no temple. What they thought was the saving sacrifice of lambs and goats took place only in the temple. The temple was destroyed in the year 70, and they're still trying to get it rebuilt. And if they do try it, they're going to have a war with the Arabs. The Muslims have their sacred mosque.
On the abortion issue,
yeah.
I was very disappointed over the last several months, preceding the election especially, the lack of comment and discussion by the clergy, not only on abortion itself, but the obligation of fellow Catholics not to support in any way any other politician that advocates abortion. And why do 50% roughly of the Catholics totally disregard that?
Yeah.
You know, it's just so hard to justify.
That was a disgrace, and it has to do with the obvious reason why the clergy didn't preach on abortion is they claim that IRS will take away your tax exemption if you use Catholic churches for political messages. But that doesn't stop Jesse Jackson. He'll use his own black church and he'll take up a collection for political parties.
Even if that's so, and they did do that, that's still not the reason for them not to speak out.
Exactly. They should defy Caesar and do that.
Exactly.
Secondly, they at least could have spoken generically. They didn't have to say don't vote for Clinton, but they could have said no one may vote for a pro-abortion candidate. That's within the limits of IRS. But the real reason is they have a tremendous fatigue. The clergy and the hierarchy above all have probably, most of them have lost their faith. There's a tremendous fatigue. They don't want it. They just want to be left alone. And they still have this kind of lame Americanism as the greatest country in the world and so on. But they don't care. This country can be feeding us to the lions and they'll still be telling us how wonderful the Bill of Rights is and all that stuff. So we're doomed. I mean, politically speaking, we're doomed.
Let me comment on that. You mentioned, could you grab that away?
No.
No. If you pick it up, we get a lot of noise.
Yeah.
Just swat a kid, it becomes fun. We're only pro-life until birth. I think you all understood that, okay? Then we're in favor of child abuse. Anyway, how much, you talk about John Rau all the time and that concept of Americanism, and I read the small paper he put out on it, and I thought it was very good. And Americanism is defined essentially as this. The American position is nothing is to be taken seriously enough to get passionate about. How much of what you're saying is actually Americanism rather than a loss of faith or a lack of energy? How much of it is actually faith in a different system? Because the thing about abortion is, I think the pro-abortionists have a much better position. There is, you know, the old, I'm personally against it. I really wish
and
it
I'm
weren't around.
And I'm not going to force you to have
right,
it. Yeah,
right,
right. Yeah,
I really wish it weren't around. But let's not you know, split over this. Let's not get ridiculous about this, okay? Let's work to prevent abortions through contraception. Let's work to prevent abortions through better sex ed. They have solutions, and they're not officially advocating abortion. What I'm saying is that how much, in your opinion, of the American bishop's failure to express this is actually based on the commitment to Americanism?
That's quite possibly it is. I'm going to give you this little pamphlet, Kevin. It's called Americanism by Mike. I wrote the preface, and this fellow, Raul Arreo, wrote the book. He notes that the American soul has two ingredients, mostly. One is this British sense of compromise, toleration, let's not be unpleasant, let's all get under the one big tent. And that, therefore, in the moment someone speaks and says, I am right and everyone else is wrong, he's considered unpleasant and he's ruining the system. The other ingredient is Calvinism, which is much worse. Now, Vinny has a point. I myself used to congratulate ourselves, saying, gee, America's this big, wide tent, and nobody's going to knock on the door at 3 in the morning and arrest me because I'm a Catholic or because I'm against abortion and all that. So I used to think it was the best possible system, but Vinny's point is, they will tolerate you saying anything you want so long as you don't take it seriously. You can say Christ is God, you can say Christ is King and all that, but God forbid you ever want to implement that into any sort of a law against pornography, against divorce and remarriage, against abortion and so on. So we Catholics in America have been, it's like being neutered. We've been castrated. We've been religiously, spiritually castrated. So the only good Catholic is a team player who says his few words along with the rabbi and the Protestant minister, but then the secular world puts in its own agenda, and the Catholic applauds that we have this wonderful freedom to keep God in the closet. That's the only thing kept in the closet. So Rayo and I think the American system is doomed. We do not think there is. The only principle of resurrection is the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church has been neutered by the American system in some part. So, but unless we get a vigorous Catholic Church with vigorous Catholic laymen, there will be no restoration in the American
system. Two things. Please let me get about that before you answer. Number one, what do you mean by doomed? But number two is a second matter, which may be related, I don't know. Several Catholics that I deal with are under the impression that, particularly because of Clinton's victory and the continuous secularization of the culture, that the American church will actually be ultimately persecuted and will have to form an underground. Comment on that.
That's the best move, yes. If only...
what do you think the possibility of that is?
I don't know. My late wife used to say, she was from France, she used to say, the only time you can have a persecution is if you always have the persecutors, but she said you have to have other people who believe. And if we have enough people who believe, they'll be persecuted. But almost everyone we know would give up Catholic faith for comfort or money or whatever.
Right.
Very few people are going to fight to the death.
But the whole concept of Americanism, never taking anything seriously enough, doesn't that automatically emasculate the persecutors? Because in order to persecute somebody, you have to take their position strongly enough to actually get up out of your chairs and go.
Oh, you might say, does it emasculate the persecutor?
I think, because Americanism, I think,
that could be a benefit.
Both sides.
Yeah. Except that they're getting ruthless now. They'll start with money, and they get absolute. I mean, right now, they're begrudgingly allowing tax deductions for charitable purposes. With a stroke of the pen, they can eliminate that. They can try forcing Catholic hospitals to perform abortions. Clinton's almost promising on that. So that's going to be, so with the money, they're going to do it. So far as mere truth goes, they won't have to. They won't have to do it. But when I say the country's doomed, there is no way for a boy and girl to get married now and live in a small community with the normal problems of baby sicknesses and that. They're going to be faced with enormous problems of crime. The schools are going to teach the people worse things. Their schools will contaminate them. Just from the point of view of money, AIDS can wipe out every health plan tomorrow because, of course, we're going to have full employment. Half the world is going to be employed as healthcare workers and undertakers because we have a social disease which was rooted in immorality. So I say, there's no way we can hire enough police, hire enough doctors and teachers to keep society going. We're doomed. There's going to be more and more money going to services which go right down the sewer. We'll have no law, no order, no education. So the real victims are going to be the young families who are trying to raise children, like the Tim Watkins and his wife, and all your in-laws and all that stuff.
So to use the fancy term, what you're talking about is the cultural infrastructure will collapse.
Yeah.
America as a nation state will continue.
Yeah, to an extent, because we have enormous power. There's such a massive amount of power and money, it will take two more generations for us to collapse, but the infrastructure, the city government, the schools, the hospitals, they're going to collapse. We'll all become wards of the state. Right now, we're all working for... I mean, the very fact that most wives are going to work now, some of them... There was always a small amount of married women with children who had to work, but then there were a lot of married women who wanted to work. Now it's going to be that everything is so artificially raised because of all the taxes and the health insurance and so on, that there won't be any home life. You won't see your children in daylight. Daycare is going to run things. You're going to have everything is going to be in this communal way. So you wonder why we work. Why do we live? And I foresee the total collapse. I take one more generation. I mean, you right now cannot walk the streets of New York safely. You cannot park safely, that's for sure. And the elementary safety of taking a subway to go from here to there is not yours. If you're rich enough, you can hire a cab or have a chauffeur. But the normal people aren't going to have it.
Okay, from a philosophical, historical, predictive point of view, what will happen at that point?
I don't know. I know Thomas Molnar, who was Rayo's mentor in a certain sense, he predicts a return to a kind of feudal system. If there's a strong warlord, might be a mafia boss or something, and you pay him tribute, he'll say, you stay in my area and I'll protect you. And that's understandable. But we're going to have to segregate communities, get private segregation, and I don't know how long that's going to last.
Another question I had is on capital punishment.
There's no moral problem with that. I know the bishop is trying to get.
I took issue with a priest recently that took the position that you could not be pro-life and be in favor of capital punishment. And I argued with him on this.
Yeah,
he accused me of having faulty theology.
You know?
I said, well, I don't think so. I said, I went to a Jesuit institution when they taught the truth.
Where'd you go to Fairfield?
Fairfield.
Oh, yeah.
I was in the fourth graduating class.
Yeah, that's
this is 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And they still taught the truth.
The very Moses who said thou shalt not kill is the very Moses who commanded capital punishment for so many crimes.
Sure, exactly. And he said, well, I had faulty theology and you know, we are...
Who was this, your parish church?
No, this was...
1 minute.
Do you know, I remember his words. He said, every life is refreshing in the eyes of God.
Yeah.
And you stand there and I won't go to that church. I don't want to go to that church.
Well, that's the same priest that told my mother that I was 89 years old because she went to the monastery, the Franciscan monastery nearby that Sunday, that she didn't fulfill her Sunday obligation. Yes, right. And
it's legalist. It's legalist.
That's nonsense, you know. I said the only thing God is interested in is the money. You know?
This is the kind of people we're talking about. The capital punishment is very, very thin. I mean, he has said other things that.
You know, Cardinal Bernadine is the one who started that seamless garment nonsense. He did that at Fortin. So a criminal is on the same level as an unborn babe. So my answer is, let's put all the unborn babes in prison uniform. Maybe we won't kill them. We won't kill them. And, you know, tell Governor Cuomo, because he's the biggest fraud in the world, that only God, when it comes to capital punishment, he vetoes it. Only God has the right to take a human life, and then he supports abortion. Yeah.
Do you ever see the possibility down the road? Unfortunately, in as long as our present pope is alive, this will never happen. The ordination of women.
It is impossible. It cannot happen. No.
The pope has the final say. So.
Yeah,
no, he doesn't.
Bishops.
Not really. Since no pope can say something infallibly wrong.
Right, exactly.
In the true sense of the word, if he were to try to say it, either couldn't get the words out or he'd be struck dead.
He'd be struck dead.
So
there's no way
he could ever
Barry Priest, yes. That's not a doctor.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's a separate matter. But then by definition, it still wouldn't be the Pope.
Yeah. Now, that can never happen. This Pope, or even the word, even if Wicklund became Pope, God could never permit
so
it.
So even though the bishops worldwide, maybe are 95%, yeah, come to the Pope and say, this is what we would like, he's not going to be able
to
do that.
The way they wanted to do a contraception, I mean, the majority of the church wanted contraception.
Right. But they'll never check the church.
And Paul VI was a setup for that, but there's where he was protected by the Holy Ghost.
Now, there would be a sin in the church.
Oh, that would be the best news in the world.
I know.
No, keep going. He's a big baby.
Let me ask this question about the schism. My personal view, you comment on it. There'll never be a schism in the United States at all. The reason is, literally, those bishops and priests who are already against the authority of Rome like the status of being a rebel, because there's something in the American culture and personality that does that. If you split off from Rome, you get one, maybe two shows on Phil Donahue, one shot on Larry King, and then like that Father Gene Stallings in Washington, D.C.,
you're nobody.
If you're Cardinal Bernardine or Bishop Wicklund, and you want to get out and daily talk about ordination of women, you can get on the Phil Donahue show once a week. Since these people are seeking men's approval rather than God's, they'll never become the schismatics that they are formally, because they lose the status of being a rebel within the church. Being a rebellious Catholic has a great deal of status. Being a Protestant, which is what you are if you leave the church, is none.
Yeah.
Comment.
I don't totally agree, but therefore, our only hope is that Rome will get turned. You're right. It in no way would pay these heretics and schismatics to announce it, because they're getting the best of both worlds. That Roman college worth a fortune. But if Rome ever says put up or shut up, then they'd shut up. I think they would be just what Pius X said to the Marvelous. He would. They're a bunch of cowards and so on. But Bernardine is still the devil of America, and he's still got... Every time we hear rumors that he's sick, but so it's wishful thinking.
Well, Wicklund isn't far behind.
Yeah, Wicklund, Brent. The kingpin of America was right there from Chicago to Cincinnati. The mid, not very important, but there are a lot of Catholics, and they had the power of the American Catholic bishops. Does anyone get the homiletic review?
Yes.
Did you read the cry of the papist priest number 2? The guy who wrote it, it's again anonymous. His name is Father Gilsdorf, the most educated priest I've ever met in my life. He wrote the cry of the papist priest 11 years ago. This is part 2. That is the most intelligent analysis of the crisis in the church you'll ever read.
Is that the recent one?
Just now came.
Yeah, we just got it, and I haven't gotten it.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to Xerox copies and send out copies to
people. You know, we got a new book recently. Yeah.
The Final Hour by Michael Brown.
Have you ever heard of that book by Michael Brown?
They're talking about the Final Hour. Talk to my wife. She goes to bed with the book.
Okay.
What? Oh,
the final hour, yes. I was asking your husband if he had read that.
Oh, we saw you there that night in Ann Segerman.
That's right.
We saw you there.
Yeah.
Great book.
Yes, I'm just winding it up now.
Yeah. I have 6 copies at home that I'm giving away. And
so you're on about the final 5 minutes then, huh?
A little more than five minutes.
Does anyone want coffee? We have decaf and real.
Any more sandwiches?
Okay, let me put it back on you.
Yeah.
All right. We're dealing with you again, teacher. And now you're not just talking to the students you deal with in your classroom. You're talking to anybody who ever hears you. What does the Joe average Catholic do today in this part of the 20th century in America? The church is bad in the sense that it seems to be unhealthy. The doctrines are pretty much ignored if they're known. The morality is ignored when it's taught. We have priests who, bishops who seem to be compromising the faith endlessly. And we have an infrastructure that's collapsing, so it makes it difficult for people to raise their children counterculturally.
Yeah.
Okay, give me a prescription for what the...
I tell people, I tell them homeschooling is number one, these little groups. of Catholics, these little circles who support each other, find a good priest like Father Peter, who's a Novus Ordo priest, by the way, not a Trinity priest, but he would learn the Trinity Mass. That is the only thing, and he's right on that. If we at least try to save our own souls and our spouse and our children, that's something. A lot of people are saving the world, but their own kids are going to hell.
I think one of the greatest tragedies we have is that we do not realize the great thing that we have in Christ and I think we have to get that and emphasis on that. It's awesome when you think that's God up there. But most of our Catholics don't even realize that. And one priest told me when he was bemoaning the fact that he had over 130 confirmation pupils, all he could find coming to Mass on Sunday was 32. And I said to him, Father, you know, if I were a young person, you wouldn't find me here either, because the Mass as it is today, for one thing. And I said, if I didn't believe in the consecration as a young person, I wouldn't be here. So I said to him, why don't you get up there and preach the true presence of Christ up there? He's emphasizing. He said, oh, he said, the emphasis today is on the presence of Christ in everybody. And he walked away, and I thought to myself, if you said that to me as a young person, I'd say, you mean to tell me what I see?
This is a circle.
This was weird, though. Huh? This was weird.
Listen, excuse me for a second. Said it was stolen away from them by the liberal preachers.
Yeah, but they would still know. They would still know that he's there.
The real presence.
We're just back on tape.
I just want to make it clear.
Here to here.
When the tabernacle was moved, we're back on tape.
Yes.
You're saying when the tabernacle was moved,
yes,
from, in many churches, from the center,
yes,
to the side, that many people are still genuflecting in the center.
Right.
And you're saying that they're not, by the genuflection is supposed to be a symbolic act acknowledging the real presence of Jesus, they're not doing it correctly anymore. I think you're right in a sense. Sometimes I do it. I'm certainly aware of the real presence. Sometimes the reason I do it is because the tabernacles are in such odd places that it's actually better to
try to replace.
And what I try to do is I try to face that way.
That's what I do.
Yes.
Because when you're leaving church, I wait till I get to the front of the church and then turn you left in that direction. But we have our candles, our votive lamp, to the side, right in front of the Blessed Sacrament. And people just walk right by that tabernacle and don't even know he's there.
All you're really saying is, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is that dogma still has to be central.
I guess,
and if the dogma is not made central, that you lose everything and the church ultimately becomes
absolutely
a social club.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Also, with the new man, and the
Father
in there, and I cannot say it, but with the new man, the acclamation of faith.
Christ
it
has
is
died.
Not
Christ
the
Christ,
mystery
yeah.
of faith. It is not the mystery of faith what we are seeing.
No.
The mystery of faith is the priest bringing Christ to the altar through his power to change the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. Now we're saying Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again, and he's there.
Yeah, we're speaking against, I have an article
it's a
that's
contradiction.
Coming out of the Latin Mass. Do you get the Latin Mass? Exactly on that point.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Remember what Father B started saying about
Pardon me, I'm going to be right
back. Our local priest,
okay,
where we go, I don't know what...
We'll be saying, no, say this.
He was...
Don't get nervous.
I just don't concentrate. He stopped. If anyone walked in a church late, he stopped. And he embarrasses people walking in the church, whether it's a weekday or a Sunday. But he was saying one day that the reason he stopped, and no one should be coming in late, because the Word of God is as important as the real presence.
First meet Jesus Christ in this church? He said, some people think it's at the Blessed Sacrament, but the truth of the matter is in the preaching of the Word of God, the Gospel. And that's why he's, what's the deuce's that? But, no, so, but I told Marie that, that it is part of doctrine that Christ is present in his word. That is, but there's still a real difference between that presence in his word. Say, Christ would be present in a tape recording, but it's much different between the tape recording and the real person that was right there. Let's line up for the coffee before we do anything else. Who wants to speak out? Well, his emphasis was totally that the word is more important than the actual.
Let me deal with, I think, probably be the last topic here. Off the tape, we were just sort of gossiping and just ordinary topic about a Catholic college. Do you think, as you stated before, that since the university teaches technical skills very well, that a Catholic college, a real one, not even if we only posit one as existing in theory, can a Catholic college justify itself? And I'll tell you the reason why I point this out. I was down recently in Front Royal, and this question came up, and I argued that no Catholic college, even a real one, could justify itself.
Why?
And, well, the basic reasons were this, and I came up with about six, but I really think the two strongest ones are this. Number one, as you were saying before about the destruction of America, ultimately, the money that is going to be spent on healthcare, et cetera, and education, quote unquote, is a sterile type money. It produces nothing.
Exactly.
If you teach someone to teach you, say, Esperanto, you've spent a lot of money, but you haven't really learned anything practical. If one can learn the faith by homeschooling, by contact with other Catholics, or through some miraculous or providential intervention by God, and one can, why does one need to go to a college to do it? That's the first argument. And the second one is, any Catholic college, by definition, can do a great deal of evil by scandal and by destruction of the faith, which a secular college cannot do. If you were to study at a St. Thomas College, make it hypothetical, and there's one heretic on the faculty, and you believe this is a real Catholic college, and he says contraception is okay, then this gives a weakened person an excuse to go out and sin, to throw it up against his parents, to throw it up against legitimate priests all the time. But if he learned it in the University of Iowa, he would simply say, what do I expect from people like that? So basically what I'm saying is the money spent on Catholic colleges, number one, is sterile. It does not produce something which feeds the hungry, clothes the naked. And number two, the possibility, the evil it does is unique, while the good it does can be done in other places.
All right, but, I mean, but the hypothesis is we have a serious Catholic college which would not have heretics, right? Now, Steubenville is trying to get a heresy-free college, and so is Christendom. Steubenville's got a couple of problems there. I think it's quite possible to have two or three faculties in Steubenville or say, Christendom, or some point where there's no heresy. So that avoids the scandal issue. Number two, not by bread alone does man live. There are spiritual works of mercy. So you have a group of young, faithful Catholics who love the faith. They deserve, and we need them to have a very sophisticated understanding of the faith, which you are not going to get merely by homeschool. You'll get the faith through a few home books and all that. But the highest level is going to take a kind of living community. There's no real substitute for a group of a couple of hundred people who love the faith, some of whom are extremely well gifted and expert and all that. You can't substitute that. So that's the raison d'etre of a Catholic college. Even if you don't earn a nickel, you're deepening your faith.
What you're saying then is one of the things which you could not achieve otherwise is the literal college experience.
Yeah.
Okay. Which could not be done no matter how much you tried. The other things you were talking about, these once a week meeting of clubs or groups or associations.
Well, if
they
the
were
other
never
ones were that or were that frequent, I guess it could be. I mean, then it's in a sense we're only quibbling about a word. In other words, if I could get 50 people every week for 4 or 5 hours discussing the faith in a very sophisticated way, and then the other 6 days a week they're reading and praying and doing this, I mean, I don't know what you want to call it, but that's what would have happened at a Catholic college that I'm envisioning. Yeah.
Okay, but based on the fact that if we went back, say, 50 years, We would probably find the University of Notre Dame, Fordham, most of the Catholic colleges, if not all in this country, heresy free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, it's the old thing of who watches the guardians. Is it not just a sort of a law of human nature based on original sin that the only way to keep something heresy free is to have maybe one faculty member and 50 people watching them? Because if you expand the faculty more than two, ultimately heresy, the devil is active. Ultimately, the heresy will sneak in. That doesn't mean to say that a Catholic college shouldn't exist. But since you argue that it could be done, I'm arguing that it could only be done for temporary periods of time. And heresy will, in all human expectations, always seep in.
Yeah, I mean, well, Fordham was flirting with heresy way before Vatican II. We had a couple of good heretics on the faculty. But first of all, they didn't have that much impact. Nevertheless, they did undermine the faith. But number two, that can be self-correcting. If the Jesuit order itself had not been infiltrated, had the Jesuits remained really Catholic, they would eventually have identified and thrown out or not given tenure to the heretics. A couple of the young heretics were Jesuits, and the order was itself sect. So you do have a mechanism. If you have a religious orders, whether they're teaching orders or not, they can go corrupt too, as we can see. They need never be corrupted, but they have this principle of resurrection and redemption. So the Jesuits from time to time were resurrected. They happen to be in the lowest state, but we have a couple of great ones now coming back again. We still had Father Chibok in any case, who was a very holy man. And then, believe it or not, the bishop is supposed to be the guardian of orthodoxy. But we've had very low-level bishops.
Of course.
The most uneducated clergy in the world are American bishops. Which is not the case with Bishop Egan of Connecticut, by the way. He's one of the best educated bishops in the church. He doesn't seem to say much, but he is highly educated. So that's our bishop here, right there.
He didn't do much, did he, when the homosexualism came up in Connecticut?
Yeah. No, that was a no-win situation, and in no way. Wait, which tuition was it?
We're essentially at the end of the tape, and I would just like to go on record as saying, number one, I thank you for inviting me and inviting Cindy, that this was a worthwhile experience. I also thank you and your wife for agreeing to this format. I think it was worthwhile. I thank you also for doing what you say. There is one thing to advocate something. It's another thing to do it. You advocate Catholic culture, Catholic exchange, Catholic conversation, Catholic congregations outside of the church. You do it. A lot of people advocate certain things, and as I say all the time, even if you don't practice what you preach, preaching is still a worthwhile thing. You do both. I want to officially go on record as thanking you for doing that, for thanking us, thank you for inviting us, and thank you for being yourself and for sharing that time with us. And I think I just express everybody's views here.
Yeah.
Outside of that, I'd just like to say that additional copies of this tape can be obtained by contacting ARM at 55 Palin Road, number 38, Hopewell Junction, New York. And I hope it's been a blessing to those of you who are listening. And that's it.